So that thank you, David, first for inviting me to give this talk. I enjoy this, and for your very generous introduction. And also, I want to thank you for the advice you gave me. David told me in preparing the talk, I should make sure that what I say does not require specialized knowledge to parse. So in preparing the slides, I kept Sarah Palin firmly in mind. And actually, I'm hoping that on her way back to Alaska, she makes a quick stop here, maybe. So I have sort of an ambitious schedule because I really want to talk about three disciplines and how they all might fit together. So topology, as David mentioned, is the one I was raised in. And then the one I came to love later as an adult is quantum mechanics. There's the box with Schrodinger's cat. And computational complexity. You know, what can be computed? How long it takes? Is it realistic? Or pie in the sky? And if you grind these all together, these three objects, supposedly comes the quantum compute. Oops. Let's see if I can get the laser. I'll try this. So out comes the quantum computer. There we go. Get the technology right. That's the quantum computer. Okay. So quantum computing is actually a new paradigm. And people will ask, well, is it 10 times faster, 100 times faster? It's not a constant times faster. If you apply it to certain problems, the computational weight or difficulty of the problem scales in a different way than a classical computer. So that the larger the problem, the larger the comparative advantage of the quantum computer. So it's really a different paradigm. So I know in these public lectures, graphics are very important. So there's the classical computer, and there's the quantum computer. And it does probably contain a nuclear warhead. Okay, now, computation in science increasingly defines what we know, what we can do. It's just sort of the way science is developing. And as far as we know, there are two regimes in which one can compute. There's classical computation, you know, like the laptop I'm using, which is based on zeros and ones. And then there's quantum computation, which has never actually been implemented, but is a theoretical idea that's now very well developed. And in some time in the next century, in this century, we expect to pass from classical to quantum. And what I'd like to do in this talk is explain what some of the consequences will be and why I think it will happen. Now, I want to recommend, this may seem like a digression, this Davis economist to the audience, Gregory Clark. I think of him as a monist, so like monotheism. And anyone who proposes a view of the world that has sort of one idea from which everything follows, string theorists should be sympathetic. Clark, fascinating idea, is that there was only one interesting event in human economic history, and it happened around 1800 in England. And this is basically the Industrial Revolution. His thesis is that up until 1800, every technological advance that was developed was immediately overwhelmed by a corresponding increase of population. So that while elites progressed and the state of knowledge progressed, the standard of living of the average person was absolutely constant between 30,000 BC and 1800 AD. So somehow for the first time in history, a real turning point occurred from his perspective. So, you know, we have a history of mankind here, and nothing happened for 100,000 years. We were just sort of feeding ourselves. And then in the Industrial Revolution, we learned to make things. And then we might add, now this is my dot, not Gregory Clark's, but we might add, well, we learned all to, you know, with the MOSFET, the, you know, basically the silicon computer chip, we learned to think and make Everyone's thinking like crazy on the web. Now, of course, we're not thinking about very interesting stuff. If you look what's on the web, we're mostly thinking about advertising and pornography, but at least it's a start, you know. Now, you know, I'm hoping that we can add another dot in the next 20 years or so. We'll do whatever the quantum analog is that we'll, you know, try to, we're sort of on a cusp where we may have a qualitative change in what we can do. Well, I like to think comparable to the previous dots on this chart. So my own interest in this is comes from sort of a confluence of three subjects, topology, quantum mechanics, and complexity. And then just like the meat grinder illustration, that little dot in the center is quantum computing. So let me start with topology. So the central topic in topology is manifolds. And manifolds are things that are locally like coordinate space, like Euclidean space. So they come in all the dimensions. There's one-dimensional manifolds, which are just loops or strings. There are surfaces, that's the green thing there. And then there are three-dimensional manifolds, which are already getting hard to draw a complete picture of on the screen, but this is some lovely rendition of the what's called the Hopf map. And then, of course, there are four and five and higher dimensional manifolds, which are harder to draw but actually easier to think about, as David mentioned. Now, manifolds are a very old-fashioned kind of thing. I think it's fair to say they personify a worldview that's simpler and long past. They're locally Euclidean. They have no existential angst. They're not like hovering between position and momentum space and don't know where they are exactly. In fact, they're resolutely in position. And you could say they're a direct extension of Kant's worldview. I actually have been reading recently about Einstein when he was quite young, before 1905, between 1900 and 1905. He was very interested in philosophy and had a group of like-minded people, young people he met with, and they really worshipped Kant, apparently. And later, when Einstein bent space, you know, and created general relativity, he was actually quite distressed that he had gone against Kant, and it took him quite a, you know, Kant was very much in Euclidean geometry, but Einstein finally resolved this and decided that Kant would have liked this if he had been around to be exposed, that it was pretty close to Euclidean. It was microscopically Euclidean, it was just bent a little bit. So manifolds are simple and beautiful things. Perhaps in the physical world by themselves they're not terribly important, but they exemplify in maybe the purest form this question that obsesses mathematics, which is local to global. A manifold is perfectly simple object locally. It's like locally like a piece of paper in case of a surface. But then the question is, how can it be wrapped up globally? You know, what are the possible global shapes? A sphere, a torus, a two-hole torus, a projective plane, a Klein bottle, and so on. This problem of classifying manifolds becomes harder as the dimension increases up to three, and then it becomes perhaps easier, higher. And to touch on the Poincaré conjecture, this is just kind of the purest example of the classification problems in manifolds. Poincaré guessed, the Poincaré conjecture, is that if a manifold sigma is what's called homotopy equivalent to the sphere, then it's homeomorphic to the sphere. So let me explain what these terms mean. Basically, homotopy equivalent, two spaces are homotopy equivalent, X1 and X2, say, if they behave the same way when receiving maps from other spaces. So basically, the maps into two spaces, if they're indistinguishable, then the spaces are homotopy equivalent. So for instance, any surface, if you consider maps of a loop into the surface, if all the loops, all maps of a loop into the surface can be shrunk to a point, then the surface is a sphere. That's an example of the Poincaré conjecture. You sort of recognize the sphere by the property it has with respect to maps. Homeomorphic means the space really is the sphere in the sense that its points can be bijectively corresponded. There's a continuous map, a one-to-one continuous map between this and the sphere. So this was rather a strong guess. You know, here's a picture of it from an I think a Scientific American article. You know, it's guessing that any space that has the right properties with respect to maps, like this red circle, can be finally shrunk away. Any rabbit-shaped space can actually be made round. You can sort of inflate it. So that's the guess. That's Poincaré's conjecture. And he formulated the conjecture around 1904. And, of course, the first case was known before he formulated it for the dimensions circle and two-sphere. It was known in the 19th century. The problem was solved in high dimensions in 59, in four dimensions in 81, and then very recently Perlman polished off the last case by completely different methods using PDEs. About 2002, though, it took about 4 years for everyone else to catch up with the fact that he had solved the problem. So that's the check mark. It's done. I wanted to mention that there's a very important distinction in higher dimensions between homeomorphic and diffeomorphic. Now, this is getting a little technical, but homeomorphic has to do with maps that correspond the points. So, like, this graph would correspond the points of the x-axis to the y-axis, and it only obeys the property that the correspondence is one-to-one. But there could be sort of crinkles in the map. It's not smooth. Diffeomorphic means the correspondence has to be appropriately smooth in both directions. And a lot of topology, believe it or not, is focused on this seemingly technical question of whether the correspondence is continuous or actually smooth. You know, sort of the difference between the polytope and the smooth bunny. And you might say that one of the best papers, I enjoyed it the most, so the enjoyment metric, I think this is the best paper in topology. And what he did is he glued these two manifolds together, very simple manifolds. He was making a three-sphere bundle over the four-sphere using left and right quaternion multiplication. But he just took they're seven-dimensional manifolds, but they're very simple. It's a sphere across a disk just in the appropriate dimensions. But he glued them together in a slightly non-obvious way, but there's a perfectly simple formula for the gluing. And he got a manifold which was, we'll call it sigma there, which is homeomorphic to this sphere, but not diffeomorphic. So there is a correspondence to the sphere, but it's not smooth. Now, 50 years later, we've sort of exhausted what we can do to impress our colleagues by just gluing two things together. But we've learned some new tricks from quantum mechanics, and we can now think about gluing sort of superpositions of manifolds together. So this is a fun game I've played with many of my colleagues recently. And I just drew a little graphic here to illustrate it. Imagine we have this circle here, and on the left it sort of bounds this surface. But you also might say, well, it also bounds this dotted surface. So let's think of it as bounding this plus that. And then the same circle can be thought of on the right, maybe with the opposite orientation, bounding this surface plus that surface. Then what would you say should happen if you glue the two together? Well, you should probably have some kind of bilinear formula. That is, everything on the left should glue to everything on the right, so there would be four terms. This glues to this, this glues to that, that glues to that, and that glues to that. So it comes out these three terms right here. Why are there three, not four? It's because we get the thing with three holes twice, by gluing this way, you see the three holes, and by gluing that way. So we kind of collect terms, and that's the answer. So you can play this game in all dimensions. You can take manifolds of dimension d minus 1, make them appear as the boundary of manifolds of dimension d. You can make them appear as linear combinations of the manifolds of dimension D and start gluing together and see what that pairing is. And the result of the investigation ultimately is that for dimensions up to three, And actually, in Dimension 3, one uses Perlman's PDE in the argument, though not his final statements. It turns out that this pairing is positive, that you never sort of get a light-like, there are no light-like vectors. Any combination of manifolds which paired with itself is trivial, is the trivial combination. But in higher dimensions, there are plenty of vectors, plenty of combinations of manifolds that when paired by themselves give zero. Now, right now I'm leaving this with you as sort of just a mathematical fact, but in the second half of my talk, this will come up actually in the physics realm. So let me go to the physics realm now. So if you can imagine this, I was surprised, I looked up this date that it was this early. I mean, Benjamin Franklin was inventing bifocals and making lightning rods and, you know, figuring out how thick molecules were by pouring oil on water. And then over in Italy, in northern Italy, here's Lagrange, and he's laying the foundations which would endure for 250 years in physics. I mean, this formulation of Lagrange called the Lagrangian, where you make the correct combination of kinetic and potential energy, strangely it's the difference rather than the sum that's important. It gives a way called least action for finding the solutions, which we now call the classical trajectories, or the classical solutions of a physical system. And it's a very strange concept from a philosophical point of view. Philosophers have called it teleological. It's like meaning goal-directed, that you compute this quantity, the action, over an entire path, and then the paths which occur in nature are the ones that extremize this action. So it's sort of like nature is looking ahead and trying to, you know, make the ball roll down the slope in such a way that at the end of the day the action will come out extremal. Well, of course, it's just a reformulation of F equals ma, but it has this strange philosophical mystery to it, which I think is only later understood through quantum mechanics. Today, almost every physical system is described by writing its Lagrangian, and physicists tell you what they're talking about by writing a long formula on the board, and usually what that long formula is the Lagrangian for the system. Now, jumping ahead 200 years, when systems are looked at lower energies, you know, which is important if you're studying like quantum mechanical systems near absolute zero at very low temperatures, there's a very important idea called renormalization. And what it boils down to is that the Lagrangian, the physical description of the system you're looking at, will look a little bit different at lower and lower and lower energies. And there's sort of a renormalization flow which gets you to the ultimate simplest description of the system. And the mathematical point with this renormalization flow is that derivatives are penalized. The terms in the Lagrangian that have the fewest derivatives become the most important at the lowest energies. And this is simply, for those of you who know the Fourier transform, that derivatives go over to multiplication by momentum. And obviously when a quantity is very small, it's much larger than its square. So looking at a system at lower and lower energies is kind of like taking this fractal and zooming this way to longer length scales. Now it turns out that the usual action in physics, things like kinetic and potential energy, they involve two derivatives. But there's this very beautiful exotic action called Chern-Simons, which instead of involving the velocity squared, which has two derivatives in it, turns out it only has one derivative. And it turns out that it's essentially a topological action, which I'll explain now. But the fact that it has one derivative means that this mysterious Chern-Simons action, which is very hard to interpret physically, it's not potential energy, it's not kinetic energy, it becomes more and more important at low temperatures. So if you start looking at quantum mechanics in dilution refrigerators and so on, you're bound to eventually run into this Chern-Simons term. And the topological feature is that, you know, in this 1 over r squared world we live in, you know, where forces are usually 1 over r squared or something like that, you really expect geometry, distances, to be extremely important. Things that are a little farther away will be less influential than things that are closer. But the Chern-Simons action is independent of metric. So it's much more qualitative. And for this reason, microscopic details of the system that are the system that's being studied tend to be irrelevant, so that universal properties of the system emerge. And we can enter this strange world where topological rather than metrical interactions become very important. And the last part of my talk will be on this system called fractional quantum Hall effect, where one actually sees this. Now, this emergence of the Chern-Simons action in dimension 3 is very consistent with that mathematical theorem I had on the board, on the slide a moment back, just to recall the shape of the statement. It's consistent because it says that when the Chern-Simons action is present, we can expect that the two-dimensional physical system may contain complete knowledge of three-dimensional topology, whereas in higher dimensions, where the theorem said there were light-like vectors in the pairing, three-dimensional quantum mechanical systems will not capture the most interesting aspects of four-dimensional topology, which are discovered by Donaldson, Seiberg, and Witten. So there's sort of a dictionary or a picture for this. That is, if you have a surface, sigma, and you think of sigma as bounding a solid body, that's this three-dimensional manifold, in this strange world of Chern-Simons theory, this bounding manifold can be thought of as a state indexed by the manifold living on the surface. So it's a state in a space of states. And if you have a combination of manifolds, you get a combination of states. And in this situation, because this Hilbert space is, you know, like all physical things, positive definite, it means that any vector, any combination of manifolds which was light-like would be zero as a physical state. So what this dictionary shows is that combinations of manifolds that are light-like can never be seen in sort of the physical system, the quantum mechanical system of a surface. But fortunately, in dimension 3, according to the theorem, there are no such light-like vectors. So the physics in two dimensions can see all the topology that Perlman analyzed in dimension 3. But this is, but contrary-wise, in one higher dimension, three-dimensional physics will miss much of what's happening in four dimensions. So basically, in summary, renormalization leads to very exotic physics, particularly in the form of these topological Chern-Simons terms at low temperatures. And the exotic physics at low temperatures is well known in the context of superconductivity and the fractional quantum Hall effect. Superconductivity is probably well known to the audience, that many materials, when cooled to a few degrees above absolute zero, lose all resistance to the flow of electricity. Fractional quantum Hall effect is an amazing different low temperature effect. This is just a little picture of a some kind of heterostructure, double quantum well made out of a fractional quantum Hall effect system. You know, it's some kind of semiconductor device, gallium arsenide, aluminum gallium arsenide, and some gold gates plated on top. This is a schematic, and that's an electron micrograph. I'm not too interested right now in explaining, you know, the engineering of how these devices are made, but more sort of giving you a sense of the surprise in the observations. So there's an effect as the magnetic field through the sample is increased. There's a classical effect where electrons are sort of dragged by the Lorentz force from one side of the system to the other, creating a sort of a transverse flow of current, which can be interpreted as a off-diagonal conductivity or, in the inverse, a resistivity. And the classical interpretation would be, as you increase the magnetic field, this transverse resistivity just increases linearly. But at very low temperatures, instead of going up linearly, there are these incredible step structures. And these are known as the quantum Hall effect. And if it's a fraction, it's the fractional quantum Hall effect. And this universality I was talking about at low temperatures, the fact that when the interactions have this non-metrical nature, when they're not looking at distance or 1 over distance squared, when the metric drops out of the interaction, physical details of the experimental device become irrelevant, and certain experimental signatures are fixed to universal values to incredibly high precision. So, for instance, this point 4 here, you know, which is the reciprocal of 2.5, this quantized resistance in, you know, universal units, h over the electron charge squared, this is exact to about 10 decimal places. And in fact, it's so exact that now, you know, the metrologists, the people who figure out the systems of measure electrical resistance in terms of the location of these plateaus. So the definition of the ohm uses the fractional quantum Hall effect now. And one of the reasons we think that a quantum computer, you know, built on topological interaction can be so exact and precise, you know, is because of this experience with the exactness of the structure of quantum Hall effect. Another view of the quantum Hall effect is sort of the engineering view, like how do you make these devices? I mean, here's this amazing futuristic looking thing. This is an MBE machine. It uses a beam of atoms to grow a crystal. And this is a dilution refrigerator, where after the crystal is grown, it's put to temperatures as low as maybe a tenth of a degree Kelvin, a hundredth of a degree Kelvin, and a tremendously powerful magnetic field is sent vertically through it, something like 15 Tesla. And then down the core of this machine is some device which has coaxial cables going up and down so that electronic signals can be taken in and out to that tiny little heterostructure, the little chip that would be down at the bottom. So So the plateau that was on the previous slide, I didn't emphasize it a little bit. This is called the five halves plateau. People in our theory group that David mentioned are thinking about how to use this plateau to build a quantum computer. So how would this work? How could one use this sort of incompressible, stable, very precise state of matter that occurs in this dilution refrigerator? What does that have to do with computing? Well, we should step back for a second and think about superposition, which is sort of the key idea in quantum mechanics. You know, state can be two things at once. A wave function describing a system can be written as a linear combination of eigenvectors for some observable. And these coefficients are sort of the amazing thing. Roughly, they're called probability amplitudes. That's what you see in the textbooks. But the key word is amplitude, not probability, because these coefficients have the property that their squares add up to 1, meaning their squares are probabilities. But the coefficients themselves, they might be negative, so it's very hard to interpret them classically. They're square roots of probabilities, and they're not at all intuitive. And in fact, if you have trouble leafing through a physics book trying to understand what an amplitude is, you shouldn't be discouraged, because our evolutionary development didn't train us to understand this concept. In fact, I think it's fair to say that no single person could have thought of this. It took all these guys, very smart people, sort of beating their heads against experiment in the early part of the last century to be forced into this idea of an amplitude. And the clearest sort of freshman course description of, you know, that leads you to an amplitude is this famous double slit experiment, where you send light, source of light, to a screen that has two slits in it, and you see the pattern of light and dark on another screen, and you compare the observed brightness picture with the separate brightness pictures that you obtain by having only one of the slits open. And what you find, instead of getting some kind of sum of brightnesses, you get a much weirder oscillatory node-antinode pattern. And the explanation is that the correct answer, what you observe, is you should not add the brightnesses. That is, you should not add the amplitude squared, but the physical thing that's important is the two paths through the two slits each have some amplitude for arriving at some point on the screen, and you should add the amplitudes and then turn them into probabilities rather than the other way around. The fact that these are different is sort of the whole discrepancy between quantum and classical. But the one on the left is what's correct. That's what nature does. The importance is that alpha and beta, the amplitudes, they might be negative numbers, so they might be able to cancel out each other out. One might be positive and one might be negative, so they could add to zero and create a dark spot or a node. Now, what do these amplitudes have to do with enhancing computational power? Well, in a cleverly designed algorithm, Peter Shor's famous factoring algorithm, what happens is that the useless computational paths are arranged to cancel out, like the dark spots in the double-slit experiment. So the paths that don't lead to useful conclusions are unobserved because the amplitudes are arranged to be positive and negative in such a way that they can eliminate each other. So how might this work in more detail? In three dimensions, when you exchange two particles, it's really an order two operation. If you do it twice, they're back to where they were, and the history of the transaction is deformable to no motion at all. But in one lower dimension, if you're living in flat land and you braid two particles around each other, move two particles around each other, they really create a braid in space-time. And if you do the operation twice, you're really not back to the history you were at if you had left the particles still. So it's quite possible that the state of a system that has particles or excitations in it in two dimensions can be altered by braiding the particles. The state vector can be made to sort of do-si-do in time. The state of the system as you braid the particles can move in the Hilbert space. And this motion is in accordance with a mathematical structure discovered by Vaughan Jones called the braid representations. And the precision that the braid representation is executed in the Hilbert space, the space that describes the state of the system, the precision of that execution, we believe, is the same as the precision of the plateaus in the quantum Hall effect. It should be at least 1 part in 10 to the 10. So we think that nature is providing in this fractional quantum Hall regime a vehicle where the state of the system by topological operations can be manipulated to extremely high precision. And this is essentially the essence of a quantum computer. A quantum computer is nothing but a physical Hilbert space in which you can at will move the state vector around according to a library of operations, which a computer scientist would call gates. This is from a cover of Scientific American about a year ago. They had an article on this idea, and this was the artist's conception of braiding the excitations in a very cold environment. The person without gloves there should be careful, since this is about 1 degree Kelvin. So how would we actually do this? How would we affect the braiding? Well, the idea that we'd worked with for a long time is these excitations, these charges, do have an electrical aspect as well as a topological aspect. So you might take, like an atomic force microscope tip, and electrostatically grab hold of the excitation and move it around. Experimentally, this threatened to be very complicated. So in the last year, we've been thinking, many of us, about sort of a sweeter solution. He used what are called the edge states of the quantum Hall system and tunneling across the system from one edge state to another to essentially do an end run around the technical problem of braiding excitations in the bulk of the system. So the key idea here is actually to build what we'd call an interferometer, but it would be a new kind of interferometer that uses quasi-particles rather than standard electrons or photons to interfere. So just to discuss very briefly the strategy, that the old strategy and then the new strategy. This is a one-slide summary of the old strategy. This sort of explains how to make a quantum computer. So the idea is you have a two-dimensional world down here, this rectangle. This is your space. This is the crystal interface between the crystal of gallium arsenide below and a aluminum gallium arsenide crystal above. And by arranging a discrepancy in the band gap between the two semiconductors, you can collect a little gas of electrons, maybe 10 to the 11th electrons in a couple square millimeters. And that's the world you're working in. That's the fractional quantum Hall fluid, if you like. And the picture shows that it's in its ground state at time zero at the bottom here. And as time evolves, what this picture shows is that two pairs of excitations are separately brought out of the vacuum in different spatial locations in this quantum Hall fluid. So this is like a particle and its antiparticle emerging from the vacuum. And this is it happening again. Now, on a real computer, we'd probably do this 1,000 times. We'd kind of ping the system in some way to excite 1,000 pairs like this. But for the view graph, two pairs is fine. So now we have 2 times 2. We have 4 particles here. And we use this, we braid them around each other. So they sort of dozy-do around each other in this two-dimensional world. And the three-dimensional picture of that motion is this braid. This is where the atomic force microscope or whatever might be used to drag them about. Then after we've made the braid we wanted, we bring them back together in pairs. And naively, you might expect they'll annihilate and return to the vacuum. And that may happen, but it also may happen that a second fusion channel is activated and that when you annihilate these pairs, some new particle emerges. And this is actually the readout mechanism for the quantum computer. The non-triviality of this braid is expressed in the fact, is reflected in the fact that there's some probability amplitude that can be computed mathematically from the braid for this pair not to annihilate cleanly to nothing, but to leave a topological residue. So that would be the measurement of the final state. So the Hilbert space is born. The braiding is a unitary transformation within the Hilbert space. And then when you try to kill the Hilbert space at the end, it refused to die. That's sort of the output. Now, the second strategy is not to really try to move the particles around, since this looks hard, but to try to measure them with tunneling currents. So to get an idea of what that means, let's suppose that what's in here is the quantum Hall fluid, and what's drawn as blue is sort of the edge of the system, or the vacuum on the outside the system. So the electron gas lives in here. This is sort of a top view. And currents represented by this dot, this sort of hypothetical particle hopping along the edge, the current may tunnel across the juncture. It has some probability of proceeding this way, but it also has a probability of backscattering at the two-point contact. And if it tunnels across, it may go into a drain somewhere outside the system. So the point is that this history of an edge excitation moving along the edge and then tunneling through the bulk and continuing to move along the other edge, that's a kind of braiding in itself of a particle that lives on the edge. So it's not too much of a stretch to think that we could accomplish the same thing by this sort of edge current followed by tunneling followed by another edge current, that we could achieve the same thing by that composition as we could by braiding particles in the bulk. There's sort of an equivalence between the bulk and the edge here. So, you know, the sort of schematic we have in mind for this, here's sort of artist's conception, is we have all these quasi-particles sitting here, and we turn on some top gates, and we bend the edge in to make actually not just one-point contact, but two-point contacts. And a pair of point contacts, that's the interferometer that I mentioned earlier, because it's possible for there to be a tunneling channel across here, or tunneling could be avoided there, but then the particle has an amplitude for tunneling here, and the two different tunneling paths can interfere with each other. And when current is measured into the drain, that's what this is, a measuring device, when current is measured into the drain, it's possible to infer what the collective charge inside sort of the interferometer loop is. And the way the computation would proceed would be by making and breaking interferometers, perhaps one every thousandth of a second, and successively measuring different charges in different pairs of excitations. And the mathematical effect of all these measurements, actually here the oval shows what we're measuring, can be drawn here. Measuring is and getting a certain outcome. If the collective charge is zero, then measuring along this loop is equivalent to sort of a death and a birth in a space-time history which runs vertically here. So in this animation, as we measure different ovals, we're creating an equivalent space-time history of charge lines. The way to translate between the left picture and the right picture is in your mind to take the picture on the left and tilt it till it's horizontal so that these four sort of x-coordinate positions become these four x-coordinate positions. And if you do that and then make these successive measurements, you produce this kind of crazy kinked braiding pattern on the right. And if we smooth out the kinks, we see that. So these two pictures are deformable one into the other. So the point is, it's a little bit laborious, but by a sequence of interferometric measurements, you can simulate braiding. So this is sort of what, at least as of this week, we regard as sort of the sweet way to try to do it. Not drag the particles around, but learn how to build interferometers. And actually, we have experimental groups collaborating with us at many universities that are actively engaged in making these interferometers. Well, suppose all this works. What would the computer do? Well, everything possible. Everything possible in a rigorous sense. So I touched on this lightly at the very beginning, but let me hit the point a little bit harder now. Though it sounds crazy to say we'll do everything possible, well, the point is we have very strong reason to believe, just from what we know about physics, the sort of its structure, that the underlying physical world is quantum mechanical, that there's sort of this classical dissipative partial reflection of the quantum world that we live in and we call ordinary reality. And the ordinary world, its logic is based on zeros and ones, and that's what our laptops run on. And that's pretty good, and we can compute certain things. But if we can move to this kind of truer domain, sort of the way the universe thinks, quantum mechanics, and compute there and use these principles, use quantum mechanical principles, in a sense, that's the ultimate transition. There's no third place to go after that. We sort of, by moving to quantum computation, we would be learning, sort of, so to speak, how to think in the way that the physical world processes information. So we'd be able to do it ourselves. So this is a bit of a prejudice, but I fairly strongly believe that there are two regimes. There are just two. There's classical and quantum. and that we will make this transition from classical to quantum in this century, and then we'll be basically in the major leagues. We'll be able to compute everything that can be computed. Now, of course, we'll get better and faster, you know, as technology progresses, but we'll be in the ultimate regime once we have a quantum computer. Okay, but that's the hype. What is everything actually? You know, what could we do? What can be computed? What can be known? Well, you know, part of the problem is we don't have a quantum computer yet, so we have to do it all from theory. You know, what would Turing have been able to say about the World Wide Web, you know, based on knowing the theory for a classical computer? You know, it wouldn't have occurred to him. So we can't know everything until we have empirical experience, but we have a few clues. Well, you think the last month or so has been bad on Wall Street. Pull up quantum computers, unless the banks have been forward-thinking, which it seems hard to believe, they'll be badly shocked because people will be able to break all the codes on the quantum computers. So actually, we're not interested in this in the Microsoft project. We would not. Creating financial havoc is not really our thing. We think much more important is the physics that will result from quantum computing. Physicists will be able to explore exotic states of matter much more efficiently by modeling them on a quantum computer rather than a classical computer, because quantum computers scale the same way that physical Hilbert spaces scale as you make the system more complex. When you add a single electron to a system of electrons, it doubles the size of the space that's needed to keep track of the spin configurations. So very quickly, as you've added 10, 20 electrons, you're already out of room on a classical computer. But a quantum computer won't be bothered by that. So we should learn a lot about these very fascinating systems of electrons that are responsible for superconductivity and for the quantum Hall effect, these so-called strongly correlated systems and magnetic systems. So superconductors are examples, these two-dimensional gases of electrons, exotic magnets. We should learn a lot about them. Another possibility, which I think is fascinating, I don't know much about it, is maybe quantum computers would be good at computing string theories. You know, there are sections of Calabi-Yau's. I'll leave that to people who know more about string theory. Maybe quantum computers will be good for designing drugs. You know, about half the pharmaceuticals nowadays create ligands for these G protein coupled receptors that all our cells have on their surfaces that regulate the cell's metabolism. And, you know, activating the channel in these receptors is really a quantum mechanical problem. I mean, you can get only so far, I think, by playing with ball and stick models and talking about points of contact. It's not a faithful representation of what's going on. But the full representation, really, I think, would need a quantum computer. Now, another kind of interesting possibility is artificial intelligence. In 1950, Alan Turing gave a public lecture, and he predicted two things. He said that computation power would grow very fast, and he gave some numbers, and he was wrong. It grew actually quite a bit faster. And then the other thing that he said during this lecture is he said that by the year 2000, he was looking 50 years ahead, we would have a hard time saying that machines were not thinking. Well, that second thing, of course, didn't happen. Machines really didn't get any smarter in those 50 years. They got more irritating, which is probably in the right direction, but not smarter. Now, without claiming that the human brain is somehow a quantum mechanical thing, it does strike me that superposition appears to resemble the huge factual background that people keep in their heads all the time that allows them to, you know, walk out of the room without bumping into objects. And I actually think that quantum computers, if they're developed, will probably give a new lease on life to AI. It'll at least give a new world for artificial intelligence to play in. Of course, if they play successfully, then there's some risk that we become obsolete. These thinking systems become more effective than we are. Well, what's the evidence that we might become obsolete? Well, you know, we appear. There may be something quantum mechanical in our thinking. We don't know that, but at least the evidence that we have is we appear to be classical information processors. That means if we go back to, the distinction I raised at the very early on between probabilities and amplitudes, we process information probabilistically, one would guess, not through coherent superposition. Whereas a quantum computer is not going to use amplitudes. A quantum computer is going to, a quantum computer is not going to use probabilities, it's going to work on amplitudes. So if quantum computers work at all, if this can be done, they'll be computing in a regime that transcends what we're able to do. The scaling rules will be different. Just as we see in Shor's algorithm for factoring numbers and breaking codes, it won't be much of a competition. It'll be like John Henry and the locomotive. So my guess is that if quantum computers work at all, then very quickly they become more capable than we are. Thank you.
Well, I'm sure there are many questions. Floor is open.
You talked about this fractional quantum Hall effect as somehow an important concept in a quantum computer, but I don't. Where's the architecture of a computer in that? And what are we talking about? Excitations in the
yes.
electron gas?
Exactly.
Kind of the bits or whatever.
Yeah. Let me go back to a picture. Sorry, this is so slow. Maybe I should try to talk while I'm pressing the button. It doesn't take that much brain power. So I had a picture of a braid, and that is supposed to be in cross-section. There we go. Yeah, so this one screen was the only place where I tried to address that question, and obviously I didn't spend much time on it. But this horizontal plane represents that two-dimensional electron gas, and the vertical direction is time. So the plane is just sitting there. This is this like millimeter square interface between two semiconductor crystals, about 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 electrons in there. And then if you draw a slice just above the zero time, you'll see like four points where this braid has crossed it, and those are these excitations you mentioned. So these are, like you might think of them as vortices. They're very discrete objects that have an extremely well-defined structure. So they're called quasi-particles, but quasi should be thought of as a pejorative. They're really quite as good as other particles. And then in time, they braid around each other. And some slide I had earlier was supposed to express the fact that when they braid around each other, the state of the system evolves in a Hilbert space. And that evolution of the state vector really is the computation. That's all any kind of quantum computer does, is evolves the state vector in time. And we just propose to do it by braiding excitations.
Thank you for the talk. I was wondering if you've given presentations to Microsoft engineers or, you know, even Bill Gates, and if so, what the response has been from those folks?
Oh, yeah, I have some good stories. I gave a talk much like this to Bill Gates, and he said I should speak to his vice president, Craig Mundy. I gave this presentation, an early version, to Craig, and he stopped me right away, and he said, "Do I understand you to say that you want me to build an institute for you in Santa Barbara?" And I said, "No, I'm thinking more of a research station like they have in Antarctica." That we don't want to go there, but we have to go where the science is. And this is where KITP is, so so we'll suffer. yes, but I have to, now the engineers, of course, at Microsoft, they mostly are familiar with software. Though actually there's a surprising amount of high energy physics knowledge amongst these engineers because of the cancellation of the superconducting supercollider in the late 80s. A lot of physicists were thrown out of work, and these physicists could program like a bat out of hell, and Microsoft hired a whole batch of them. So it's quite interesting to give a talk at Microsoft and find people in the audience who know much more about scattering matrices than I do. I'm sorry, I maybe didn't answer your question.
There was a talk in one of these earlier, part of this earlier series several years ago by Roger Penrose, where he talked about, in particular, consciousness and its possible impact of quantum mechanics and that. I don't know if you are at all familiar with his work and any comments on that.
Actually, I've spent a fair amount of time trying to understand Penrose. I'd call it a work in progress. I have tremendous respect for Penrose, so I would not want to criticize, just understand, but I haven't succeeded yet. Oh, maybe you need a microphone.
Can you give us an analogy that would explain how doing this in the physics would allow you to compute things faster or more efficiently than classical computing?
Sure.
Is there an analogy that we can think about?
No,
that's the physics of it, but is there an analogy?
That's a very good question because, again, you know, as with this screen, I only devoted like 30 seconds to, you know, why quantum mechanics might make some computations very fast. And all I really said is something about the dark spots on the double slit experiment, you know, and you probably thought, what? So let me try to amplify that. So the connection with the double slit experiment is that, you know, when you look at the screen, some places that were dimly illuminated but still illuminated when one slit or the other was open now are black. And the reason is that the light from the two possible routes has interfered and canceled. So you should think that you should think of these as bad computational outcomes that you never look at. That you sample the outcome according to brightness, and you only see the useful result. Now the way this works more specifically, like in the factoring algorithm, is factoring is reduced very quickly to a period finding problem. Some function is it's a residue of a power. Some function is created in the register or stored in the register of the quantum computer, and it's immediately moved into what physicists would call the Fourier domain, where you don't store the function as a function of the individual powers, but you store it in terms of its overlap with waves, with its resonances. And when it's stored that way, when it's stored in the Fourier domain, it's incredibly efficient because when you sample the function by measurement, what you're going to do is you're going to grab the frequency, the wavelength, you're going to grab that component that has the most amplitude. Is the probability of seeing, when you measure, the probability of seeing a basis vector is going to be just the amplitude squared. So that means that you have almost no probability of seeing the waves for which there's little overlap, and you have high probability of seeing the waves for which there's strong overlap. So even though there's this ungodly number of Fourier modes, you don't have to sort through them all. When you just measure, you already see with fairly high probability the relevant Fourier mode, and you find the underlying frequency. Yeah.
Again.
This may be really going out on a limb, other than that my undergraduate thesis advisor postulated this, that you said it doesn't get any better than quantum mechanics because that's the physics of the universe, but what about the possibility the physics of the universe is running in some meta system and that we could tap into that? Is that at all plausible?
Well, I love thinking about things like that. I agree with the idea that there may be levels and levels and levels going down, but my own belief is that they're probably all quantum mechanical. So, in other words, when I said that it's a pejorative to call these quasi-particles, I mean, what I was thinking in the back of my mind is, electrons, which we think of resolutely as particles, well, there's some excitation, in some background, and we just don't know the physics microscopically well enough to know the details of that background. So to us, they seem fundamental particles, but maybe they do need a certain background to exist in. I mean, that's what I was thinking there. But I think the evidence is there's a lot of good theoretical evidence that quantum mechanics can't be tampered with very much. That is, if you try to add some nonlinear terms, you produce strange effects. You quickly violate causality or allow the construction of impossibly powerful computers that could solve NP-complete problems. Also, if you start tampering with the foundations of quantum mechanics, if you'd say, well, quantum mechanics isn't an exact description, you get into a weird problem with the idea of indistinguishability. One of the real foundations for our understanding of physics is that there are classes like electrons, or photons, and particles that are indistinguishable one from another. And if you start thinking the description is approximate, then you start thinking, well, maybe there are like little freckles and marks if we looked fine enough. And then, but you see the evidence of like how metals work and so on rests very strongly on electrons really being indistinguishable, and we have this Fermi C and all this. So it's pretty hard to start tampering with quantum mechanics. I mean, maybe someone will see a way, but it's a very rigid structure and it doesn't like to be messed with.
I'm interested in, call it finite element analysis in the broadest sense, whether it's fluid flow, heat transfer, structures. And in those, people just want more and more powerful computers to make smaller and smaller elements.
Yes.
To get more and more accurate results. Is it possible with a quantum computer that you could just simulate fluid flow in a sort of native sense, natural sense? Mm.
I would say this is an open research problem. There's actually a couple papers posted in the last year. It's a guy, Abrams, who's been posting papers claiming exponential speed up for the solution of linear differential equations with vastly large number of variables. So he claims, it is claimed in the published literature that this very classical problem of solving ODEs can be speeded up. I'm not sure, actually.
Are you saying that the process can just be speeded up?
No, exponentially. I mean, it's the same scaling. So in other words, what is well established is that there are quantum algorithms for sampling the spectrum of a Hamiltonian. So if you have a Hamiltonian operator, you can sample the spectrum very efficiently. Whereas classically, really all you can do with a Hamiltonian is you can peel off the highest and lowest eigenvalues. And then when you try to go past the first or second eigenvalue, things get very slow. Quantum mechanically, you can kind of democratically go in and sample all the eigenvalues. Now, sampling eigenvalues from Hermitian operators, is, as you probably know, is very close to solving differential equations.
Thank you. There's a logical leap that's very tempting to make that you're clearly avoiding, and I wonder if you could just help us resist it. And that is that you're seeing these two different types of computing, classical and quantum, and the classical has so far resisted an ability to show particular intelligence, whereas clearly brains have achieved that intelligence. So the natural sort of tempting inference is to think that somehow brains are drawing on some kind of quantum computing. And what is the grounds for being certain that that isn't the case?
I'm not certain. I'm agnostic. I mean, the grounds for being skeptical is decoherence, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, the systems that we're optimistic about are at a hundredth of a degree Kelvin. So, you know, if quantum information is somehow protected in our brains, it's protected in a way that is unfathomable to us now. Maybe David would want to be even stronger.
Isn't your point that, I mean, brains are powerful because they're highly parallel, and quantum computing is highly parallel in a sense of effort. And although those aren't the same, they share parallelism. Isn't that what you're thinking about? That's what you mean by...
When I said the background of information, right, there's this kind of cloud of facts, but I don't attribute that in my own thinking to quantum mechanical superposition. I think it's an analog, and as David said, they're both aspects of parallelism. So I think that what brains are probably are amazing classical computers. You know, it's like because there's been, you know, hundreds of millions of years of evolution fine-tuning this, various information processing tricks, you know, involving the visual system and all our abstract thinking, you know, is surely co-opting things that originally were survival skills. You know, like in mathematics, when we, you know, if you think about mathematics, you could say, well, there's, algebra, differential equations, geometry, or something like that. It's like counting, dynamics, geometry. So it's, you could, each of those you could think is some kind of primal survival skill, you know, like counting your sheep and throwing your spear. And so I'm sure that, you know, what I feel is that, you know, when we think abstract things, we do mathematics, we're taking a machinery that's designed, you know, by evolution for survival skills in a very primitive environment, and we're using what works and pushing aside the stuff that doesn't, and it's amazing we can get anywhere at all, you know, with this ill-designed machine, but it seems to barely work. We have to have conferences and talk to a lot of other people. Nothing's clear, it takes years, but it kind of works. But my feeling is that, you know, we do have a pretty amazing piece of hardware up there, but it's classical, and that if these amazing pieces of hardware in the quantum realm can actually come to fruition, what they're going to do is sort of will be untouchable.
So you pick the fractional quantum Hall effect and 2D electron gases and manipulating these quasi-particles as one way of achieving this. Yeah. Now, over the past few years, there have been other attempts, other to do this physically. Can you quickly update us why you picked this one and what's wrong with the others?
Yeah. So the question is this topological approach to quantum computation is increasingly popular one, but it's, I think, certainly a minority. Most of the research has to do with quantum computing with intrinsic degrees of freedom, so like the spin of an electron, the polarization of a photon, something like that. And the problem there is that all the operations you do, like you, you know, nonlinear Kerr effect or something, optically decouple two photons, or some coupling between spins of electrons, all these operations you do will be imprecise because they will depend on how long you bring the two degrees of freedom in contact and how strong a field, the magnetic field you apply, and so on. The topological operations have to do with this braid group representation, which is going to be precise in the system, you know, to 10 decimal places. So the topological approach allows you to, in principle, if you can get it to work, manipulate the state vector with accuracy that you would not be able to achieve by microscopic degrees of freedom. Well, let me answer your question. You said, should we afraid them? I think only in the existential sense that we like to be in charge. I mean, we like to have the best ideas and work them out on the computer, not the other way around.
Following your approach, if this is successful, will all the computers be at fractions of a degree Kelvin? I mean, how will this work?
Yeah. Yeah, that is kind of dismal to think that it's so hard to do. So, it was thought in the 50s, I don't remember now who said this, maybe someone in the audience does, that it was predicted by one of the pioneers that there'd be like five computers eventually. Was it? Supposedly Watson, yeah. And now that's sort of the way we're thinking, you know, of quantum computers. But of course, things will change. As soon as we have any kind of quantum computer working, the first thing we'll do is study these condensed matter systems, magnetic systems, you know, like high-TC superconductors, colossal magnetoresistors, and we'll study these very frustrated systems. And it's possible that some of these can be put into a topological phase if we understood them better. So I'd say we take our first quantum computer and we study magnetic systems up the wazoo, and we build a computer that has energy scales that are 100 degree Kelvin instead of a tenth of a degree Kelvin. That would be, you know, the next step.
I understand that if you're talking about building a quantum computer, is there? Can you describe an element of a quantum computer? What is the equivalent in quantum of a gate, for example?
Oh well, so one equivalence of a gate would be simply this operation in time, where you braid. So you have these two excitations, and you move one around the other. I guess a half turn is the fundamental object that, in projection, looks like a crossing like that. That would be a gate, because it would return the particles to their original position. The fact that these are indistinguishable particles means that if we just do a 180-degree turn in a pair, even though we've moved A to B and B to A, they're indistinguishable. So the system has been returned to the same positions, but the state vector will have been affected by that braiding motion. So that's a gate. You know, we'll have rotated the vector. In the other paradigm, where I was talking about interferometers, those little hands that were reaching out, these things, this would be the fundamental gate. So the gate would be you know, you take these arms, you reach out, you get a little disk in which you have a small number, 2, 3, 4 particles. And the purpose of this experiment is to measure the collective charge of this within this little bag. And measuring it, you know, this is this uncertainty principle. Measuring any aspect of a quantum mechanical system changes the system, and that change is the gate that you're executing. Yeah. Just like, you know, you wouldn't build a classical computer with just an and or an or. You also want a not. You know, you know what's necessary to get a complete language. Similarly, there's a well-worked-out mathematical theory of in these quantum Hall effect regimes of what operations give a universal set of operations so that any computation can be expressed in terms of them. Now, the five halves theory is actually kind of a borderline case. The operations that are perfectly protected, you know, up to 10 decimal places topologically, are not quite universal. There's something missing. And this is sort of a little fly in the ointment. We can either use perhaps a slightly more delicate state whose operations are actually universal. But I think technologically it's probably better just to stick with the five halves and introduce one non-universal operation and error correct on it. I mean, that's sort of a technological detail.
Okay. Let's thank Michael again.
Well, thank you.
And there are refreshments, as usual, in the common room.
We met at one of